exchange ideas and experiences for 2 weeks while we awaited trial. Each day, we put together a program of activities. Patrick Molo and Peter Ntiti, both prominent youth leaguers, organized physical training. Talks on a variety of subjects were scheduled, and we heard Professor Matthews discourse on both the history of the ANC and the American Negro. Debbie Singh lectured on the history of the SAIC. Arthur Letelli discussed the African medicine man, while Reverend James Kalata spoke on African music and sang in his beautiful tenor voice. Every day, Vuisili Mini, who years later was hanged by the government for political crimes, led the group in singing freedom songs. One of the most popular was, "Here's the black man, Streetsdom. Beware the black man, Streetsdom." We sang at the top of our lungs, and it kept our spirits high. One time, Masabalala Yangwa, better known as M.B. Yangwa, the son of a Zulu laborer and the provincial secretary of the Natal ANC, contributed to a lecture on music by reciting a praise song in honor of Shaka, the legendary Zulu warrior and king. Yangwa draped himself with a blanket, rolled up a newspaper to imitate an assegai, and began to stride back and forth reciting the lines from the praise song. All of us, even those who did not understand Zulu, were entranced. At the conclusion of the song, pandemonium broke out. Chief Letuli, who until then had remained quiet, sprang to his feet and bellowed, "That is Shaka!" and then began to dance and chant. His movements electrified us, and we all took to our feet. Accomplished ballroom dancers, sluggards who knew neither traditional nor Western dancing, all joined in the Ndlamu, the traditional Zulu war dance. Some moved gracefully, others resembled frozen mountaineers trying to shake off the cold, but all danced with enthusiasm and emotion. Suddenly, there were no Xhosas or Zulus or Indians or Africans, no rightists or leftists, no religious or political leaders. We were all nationalists and patriots bound together by a love of our common history, our culture, our country, and our people. In that moment, something stirred deep inside all of us, something strong and intimate that bound us to one another. In that moment, we felt the hand of the great past that made us what we were, and the power of the great cause that linked us all together. After the 2 weeks, we appeared for our preparatory examination on December 19th at the drill hall in Johannesburg, a military structure not normally used as a court of justice. It was a great bare barn of a building with a corrugated iron roof and was considered the only public building large enough to support a trial of so many accused. We were taken in sealed police vans, escorted by a half dozen troop carriers filled with armed soldiers. One would have thought a full-scale civil war was underway from the precautions the state was taking with us. A massive crowd of our supporters was blocking traffic in Twist Street. We could hear them cheering and singing, and they could hear us answering from inside the van. The trip became a triumphal procession, as the slow-moving van was rocked by the crowd. The entire perimeter of the hall was surrounded by gun-toting policemen and soldiers. The vans were brought to an area behind the hall and parked so that we alighted straight from the van into the courtroom. Inside, we were met by another crowd of supporters, so that the hall seemed more like a raucous protest meeting than a staid court of law. We walked in with our thumbs raised in the ANC salute and nodded to our supporters sitting on the non-whites-only section. The mood inside was more celebratory than punitive, as the accused mingled with reporters and friends. The government was charging all 156 of us with high treason and a countrywide conspiracy to use violence to overthrow the present government and replace it with a communist state. The period covered by the indictment was October 1, 1952, through December 13, 1956. It included the Defiance Campaign, the Sophiatown removal, and the Congress of the People. The South African law of high treason was based not on English law, but on Roman-Dutch antecedents, and defined high treason as a hostile intention to disturb, impair, or endanger the independence or safety of the state. The punishment was death. The purpose of a preparatory examination was to determine whether the government's charges were sufficient to put us on trial in the Supreme Court. There were two stages of giving evidence. The first stage took place in a magistrate's court. If the magistrate determined that there was sufficient evidence against the accused, the case would move to the Supreme Court and be tried before a judge. If the magistrate decided there was insufficient evidence, the defendants were discharged. The magistrate was Mr. F.C. Wessel, the chief magistrate from Bloemfontein. That first day, when Wessel began to speak in his quiet voice, it was impossible to hear him. The state had neglected to provide microphones and loudspeakers, and the court was adjourned for 2 hours while amplification was sought. We assembled in a courtyard and had what was very much like a picnic, with food sent in from the outside. The atmosphere was almost festive. 2 hours later, court was recessed for the day because proper loudspeakers had not been found. To the cheers of the crowd, we were once again escorted back to the fort. The next day, the crowds outside were even larger, the police more tense. 500 armed police surrounded the drill hall. When we arrived, we discovered that the state had erected an enormous wire cage for us to sit in. It was made of a diamond mesh wire, attached to poles and scaffolding with a grill at the front and top. We were led inside and sat on benches, surrounded by 16 armed guards. In addition to its symbolic effect, the cage cut us off from communication with our lawyers, who were not permitted to enter. One of my colleagues scribbled on a piece of paper, which he then posted on the side of the cage, "Dangerous. Please, do not feed." Our supporters and organization had assembled a formidable defense team, including Bram Fischer, Norman Rosenberg, Israel Meisels, Maurice Franks, and Vernon Beranger. None of them had ever seen a structure in court before. Franks lodged a powerful protest in open court against the state's humiliating his clients in such a fantastic fashion and treating them, he said, like wild beasts. Unless the cage was removed forthwith, he announced, the entire defense team would walk out of court. After a brief adjournment, the magistrate decided that the cage would be pulled down. In the meantime, the front of it was removed. Only then did the state begin its case. The chief prosecutor, Mr. Van Niekerk, began reading part of an 18,000-word address outlining the Crown case against us. Even with amplification, he was barely audible against the shouting and singing outside. And at one point, a group of policemen rushed out. We heard a revolver shot, followed by shouts and more gunfire. The court was adjourned while the magistrate held a meeting with counsel. 20 people had been injured. The reading of the charges continued for the next 2 days. Van Niekerk said that he would prove to the court that the accused, with help from other countries, were plotting to overthrow the existing government by violence and impose a communist government on South Africa. This was the charge of high treason. The state cited the Freedom Charter as both proof of our communist intentions and evidence of our plot to overthrow the existing authorities. By the third day, much of the cage had been dismantled. Finally, on the fourth day, we were released on bail. Bail was another example of the sliding scale of apartheid. £250 for whites, £100 for Indians, and £25 for Africans and coloureds. Even treason was not colorblind. Well-wishers from diverse walks of life came forward to guarantee bail for each of the accused, gestures of support that later became the foundation for the Treason Trial Defense Fund, started by Bishop Reeves, Alan Payton, and Alex Heppel. The fund was ably administered during the trial by Mary Benson and then Frieda Levson. We were released provided we reported once a week to the police and were forbidden from attending public gatherings. Court was to resume in early January. The following day, I was at my office bright and early. Oliver and I had both been in prison, and our caseload had mounted in the meantime. While trying to work that morning, I was visited by an old friend named Jabavu, a professional interpreter whom I had not seen for several months. Before the arrests, I had deliberately cut down my weight in anticipation of prison, where one should be lean and able to survive on little. In jail, I had continued my exercises, and was pleased to be so trim. But Jabavu eyed me suspiciously. "Madiba," he said, "why must you look so thin?" In African cultures, portliness is often associated with wealth and well-being. He burst out, "Man, you were scared of jail, that is all. You have disgraced us, we toss us." Chapter 24. Even before the trial, my marriage to Evelyn had begun to unravel. In 1953, Evelyn had become set on upgrading her 4-year certificate in general nursing. She enrolled in a midwifery course at King Edward VII Hospital in Durban that would keep her away from home for several months. This was possible because my mother and sister were staying with us and could look after the children. During her stay in Durban, I visited her on at least one occasion. Evelyn returned, having passed her examinations. She was pregnant again, and later that year gave birth to Makaziwe, named after the daughter we had lost 6 years before. In our culture, to give a new child the name of a deceased child is considered a way of honoring the earlier child's memory and retaining a mystical attachment to the child who left too soon. Over the course of the next year, Evelyn became involved with the Watchtower organization, part of the Church of Jehovah's Witnesses. Whether this was due to some dissatisfaction with her life at the time, I do not know. The Jehovah's Witnesses took the Bible as the sole rule of faith and believed in a coming Armageddon between good and evil. Evelyn zealously began distributing their publication, The Watchtower, and began to proselytize me as well, urging me to convert my commitment to the struggle to a commitment to God. Although I found some aspects of the Watchtower's system to be interesting and worthwhile, I could not and did not share her devotion. There was an obsessional element to it that put me off. From what I could discern, her faith taught passivity and submissiveness in the face of oppression, something I could not accept. My devotion to the ANC and the struggle was unremitting. This disturbed Evelyn. She had always assumed that politics was a youthful diversion, that I would someday return to the Transkei and practice there as a lawyer. Even as that possibility became remote, she never resigned herself to the fact that Johannesburg would be our home, or let go of the idea that we might move back to Mthatha. She believed that once I was back in the Transkei, in the bosom of my family, acting as counselor to Sabata, I would no longer miss politics. She encouraged Daliwanga's efforts to persuade me to come back to Mthatha. We had many arguments about this, and I patiently explained to her that politics was not a distraction, but my life work, that it was an essential and fundamental part of my being. She could not accept this. A man and a woman who hold such different views of their respective roles in life cannot remain close. I tried to persuade her of the necessity of the struggle, while she attempted to persuade me of the value of religious faith. When I would tell her that I was serving the nation, she would reply that serving God was above serving the nation. We were finding no common ground, and I was becoming convinced that the marriage was no longer tenable. We also waged a battle for the minds and hearts of the children. She wanted them to be religious, and I thought they should be political. She would take them to church at every opportunity and read them Watchtower literature. She even gave the boys Watchtower pamphlets to distribute in the township. I used to talk politics to the boys. Tembi was a member of the Pioneers, the juvenile section of the ANC, so he was already politically cognizant. I would explain to Magato in the simplest terms how the black man was persecuted by the white man. Hanging on the walls of the house, I had pictures of Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, Gandhi, and the storming of the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg in 1917. I explained to the boys who each of the men was and what he stood for. They knew that the white leaders of South Africa stood for something very different. One day, Magato came running into the house and said, "Daddy, Daddy, there is Malan on the hill." Malan had been the first nationalist prime minister, and the boy had confused him with a Bantu education official, Willie Marie, who had announced that he would that day address a public meeting in the township. I went outside to see what Magato was talking about, for the ANC had organized a demonstration to ensure that the meeting did not succeed. As I went out, I saw a couple of police vans escorting Marie to the place he was meant to speak. But there was trouble from the start, and Marie had fled without delivering his speech. I told Magato that it was not Milan, but might as well have been. My schedule in those days was relentless. I would leave the house very early in the morning and return late at night. After a day at the office, I would usually have meetings of one kind or another. Evelyn could not understand my meetings in the evening, and when I returned home late, suspected I was seeing other women. Time after time, I would explain what meeting I was at, why I was there, and what was discussed. But she was not convinced. In 1955, she gave me an ultimatum. I had to choose between her and the ANC. Walter and Albertina were very close to Evelyn, and their fondest wish was for us to stay together. Evelyn confided in Albertina. At one point, Walter intervened in the matter, and I was very short with him, telling him it was none of his business. I regretted the tone I took because Walter had always been a brother to me, and his friendship and support had never faltered. One day, Walter told me he wanted to bring someone over to the office for me to meet. He did not tell me that it was my brother-in-law, and I was surprised, but not displeased, to see him. I was pessimistic about the marriage, and I thought it was only fair to inform him of my feelings. We were discussing this issue cordially among the three of us when either Walter or I used a phrase like, "men such as ourselves," or something of that ilk. Evelyn's brother-in-law was a businessman opposed to politics and politicians. He became very huffy and said, "If you chaps think you are in the same position as myself, that is ridiculous. Do not compare yourselves to me." When he left, Walter and I looked at each other and started laughing. After we were arrested in December and kept in prison for 2 weeks, I had one visit from Evelyn. But when I came out of prison, I found that she had moved out and taken the children. I returned to an empty, silent house. She had even removed the curtains, and for some reason I found this small detail shattering. Evelyn had moved in with her brother, who told me, "Perhaps it is for the best. Maybe when things will have cooled down, you will come back together." It was reasonable advice, but it was not to be. Evelyn and I had irreconcilable differences. I could not give up my life in the struggle, and she could not live with my devotion to something other than herself and the family. She was a very good woman, charming, strong, and faithful, and a fine mother. I never lost my respect and admiration for her, but in the end, we could not make our marriage work. The breakup of any marriage is traumatic, especially for the children. Our family was no exception, and all of the children were wounded by our separation. Magato took to sleeping in my bed. He was a gentle child, a natural peacemaker, and he tried to bring about some sort of reconciliation between me and his mother. Makaziwe was still very small, and I remember one day when I was not in prison or in court, I visited her creche, nursery school, unannounced. She had always been a very affectionate child, but that day, when she saw me, she froze. She did not know whether to run to me or retreat, to smile or frown. She had some conflict in her small heart which she did not know how to resolve. It was very painful. Tembi, who was 10 at the time, was the most deeply affected. He stopped studying and became withdrawn. He had once been keen on English and Shakespeare, but after the separation, he seemed to become apathetic about learning. The principal of his school spoke to me on one occasion, but there was little that I was able to do. I would take him to the gym whenever I could, and occasionally he would brighten a bit. There were many times when I could not be there, and later, when I was underground, Walter would take Tembi with him along with his own son. One time, Walter took him to an event, and afterward Walter said to me, "Man, that chap is quiet." Following the breakup, Tembi would frequently wear my clothes, even though they were far too large for him. They gave him some kind of attachment to his too often distant father. Chapter 25. On January 9th, 1957, we once again assembled in the drill hall. It was the defense's turn to refute the state's charges. After summarizing the Crown's case against us, Vernon Baranger, our lead counsel, announced our argument. "The defense," he said, "will strenuously repudiate that the terms of the Freedom Charter are treasonable or criminal. On the contrary, the defense will contend that the ideas and beliefs which are expressed in this charter, although repugnant to the policy of the present government, are such as are shared by the overwhelming majority of mankind of all races and colors, and also by the overwhelming majority of the citizens of this country." In consultation with our attorneys, we had decided that we were not merely going to prove that we were innocent of treason, but that this was a political trial in which the government was persecuting us for taking actions that were morally justified. But the drama of the opening arguments was succeeded by the tedium of court logistics. The first month of the trial was taken up by the state's submission of evidence. One by one, every paper, pamphlet, document, book, notebook, letter, magazine, and clipping that the police had accumulated in the last 3 years of searches was produced and numbered, 12,000 in all. The submissions ranged from the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights to a Russian cookbook. They even submitted the two signs from the Congress of the People, "Soup with Meat" and "Soup Without Meat." During the preparatory examination, which was to last for months, we listened day after day as African and Africana detectives read out their notes of ANC meetings or transcripts of speeches. These recountings were always garbled and often either nonsensical or downright false. Baranje later revealed in his deft cross-examination that many of the African detectives were unable to understand or write English, the language in which the speeches were given. To support the state's extraordinary allegation that we intended to replace the existing government with a Soviet-style state, the Crown relied on the evidence of Professor Andrew Murray, head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Cape Town. Murray labeled many of the documents seized from us, including the Freedom Charter itself, as communistic. Professor Murray seemed, at the outset, relatively knowledgeable, but that was until Baranje began his cross-examination. Baranje said that he wanted to read Murray a number of passages from various documents and then have Murray label them communistic or not. Beranger read him the first passage, which concerned the need for ordinary workers to cooperate with each other and not exploit one another. Communistic, Marie said. Beranger then noted that the statement had been made by the former premier of South Africa, Dr. Malan. Beranger proceeded to read him two other statements, both of which Professor Murray described as communistic. These passages had in fact been uttered by the American presidents Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson. The highlight came when Beranger read Murray a passage that the professor unhesitatingly described as communism straight from the shoulder. Beranger then revealed that it was a statement that Professor Murray himself had written in the 1930s. In the seventh month of the trial, the state said it would produce evidence of planned violence that occurred during the Defiance campaign. The state called the first of their star witnesses, Solomon Ngubasi, who offered sensational evidence that seemed to implicate the ANC. Ngubasi was a soft-spoken fellow in his late 30s, with a shaky command of English, who was currently serving a sentence for fraud. In his opening testimony, Ngubasi told the court he had obtained a Bachelor of Arts degree from Fort Hare and that he was a practicing attorney. He said he became secretary of the Port Elizabeth branch of the ANC as well as a member of the National Executive Committee. He claimed to have been present at a meeting of the National Executive when a decision was made to send Walter Sisulu and David Bopape to the Soviet Union to procure arms for a violent revolution in South Africa. He said he was present at a meeting that planned the 1952 Port Elizabeth riot and that he had witnessed an ANC decision to murder all whites in the Transkei in the same manner as the Mau Mau in Kenya. Ngubasi's dramatic testimony caused a stir in and out of court. Here, at long last, was evidence of a conspiracy. But when Ngubasi was cross-examined by Vernon Beranger, it was revealed that he was equal parts madman and liar. Beranger, whose cross-examination skills earned him the nickname Isangoma, a diviner or healer who exorcises an illness, among the accused, quickly established that Ngubasi was neither a university graduate nor a member of the ANC, much less a member of the National Executive Committee. Beranger showed that Ngubasi had forged certificates for a university degree, had practiced law illegally for several years, and had a further case of fraud pending against him. At the time of the meeting he claimed to have attended to plan the Port Elizabeth riot, he was serving a sentence for fraud in a Durban jail. Almost none of Ngubasi's testimony bore even a remote resemblance to the truth. At the end of his cross-examination, Beranger asked the witnesses, "Do you know what a rogue is?" Ngubasi said he did not. "You, sir, are a rogue," Beranger exclaimed. Joe Slovo, one of the accused and a superb advocate, conducted his own defense. He was an irritant to the state because of his sharp questions and attempts to show that the state was the violator of laws, not the Congress. Slovo's cross-examination was often as devastating as Beranger's. Detective Jeremiah Molson, one of the few African members of the special branch, claimed to recall lines verbatim from ANC speeches that he attended. But what he reported was usually gibberish or outright fabrication. Slovo, "Do you understand English?" Molson, "Not so well." Slovo, "Do you mean to say that you reported these speeches in English, but you don't understand English well?" Molson, "Yes, Your Worship." Slovo, "Do you agree that your notes are a lot of rubbish?" Molson, "I don't know." This last response caused an outbreak of laughter from the defendants. The magistrate scolded us for laughing and said, "The proceedings are not as funny as they may seem." At one point, Vessel told Slovo that he was impugning the integrity of the court and fined him for contempt. This provoked the fury of most of the accused, and it was only Chief Lituli's restraining hand that kept a number of the defendants from being cited for contempt as well. As the testimony continued, much of it tedious legal maneuvering, we began to occupy ourselves with other matters. I often brought a book to read or a legal brief to work on. Others read newspapers, did crossword puzzles, or played chess or Scrabble. Occasionally, the bench would reprimand us for not paying attention, and the books and puzzles would disappear. But slowly, as the testimony resumed its snail's pace, the games and reading material re-emerged. As the preparatory examination continued, the state became increasingly desperate. It became more and more apparent that the state was gathering, often fabricating, evidence as it went along, to help in what seemed to be a lost cause. Finally, on September 11th, 10 months after we had first assembled in the drill hall, the prosecutor announced that the state's case in the preparatory examination was completed. The magistrate gave the defense 4 months to sift through the 8,000 pages of typed evidence and 12,000 documents to prepare its case. The preparatory examination had lasted for the whole of 1957. Court adjourned in September, and the defense began reviewing the evidence. 3 months later, without warning and without explanation, the Crown announced that charges against 61 of the accused were to be dropped. Most of these defendants were relatively minor figures in the ANC, but also among them were Chief Lituli and Oliver Tambo. The Crown's release of Lituli and Tambo pleased but bewildered us. In January, when the government was scheduled to sum up its charges, the Crown brought in a new prosecutor, the formidable Oswald Pirot, QC. Pirot was a former Minister of Justice and of Defense and a pillar of National Party politics. He was a longtime Afrikaner nationalist and an outspoken supporter of the Nazi cause. He once described Hitler as the greatest man of his age. He was a virulent anti-communist. The appointment of Pirot was new evidence that the state was worried about the outcome and attached tremendous importance to a victory. Before Pirot's summing up, Béranger announced he would apply for our discharge on the grounds that the state had not offered sufficient evidence against us. Pirot opposed this application for dismissal and quoted from several inflammatory speeches by the accused, informing the court that the police had unearthed more evidence of a highly dangerous conspiracy. The country, he said portentously, was sitting on top of a volcano. It was an effective and highly dramatic performance. Pirot changed the atmosphere of the trial. We had become overconfident and were reminded that we were facing a serious charge. "Don't fool yourselves," counsel told us. "You people might go to jail." Their warnings sobered us. After 13 months of the preparatory examination, the magistrate ruled that he had found sufficient reason for putting us on trial in the Transvaal Supreme Court for high treason. Court adjourned in January with the 95 remaining defendants committed to stand trial. When the actual trial would begin, we did not know. Chapter 26. One afternoon, during a recess in the preparatory examination, I drove a friend of mine from Orlando to the medical school at the University of the Witwatersrand and went past Baragwanath Hospital, the premier black hospital in Johannesburg. As I passed a nearby bus stop, I noticed out of the corner of my eye a lovely young woman waiting for the bus. I was struck by her beauty, and I turned my head to get a better look at her, but my car had gone by too fast. This woman's face stayed with me. I even considered turning around to drive by her in the other direction, but I went on. Some weeks thereafter, a curious coincidence occurred. I was at the office, and when I popped in to see Oliver, there was this same young woman with her brother sitting in front of Oliver's desk. I was taken aback and did my best not to show my surprise or my delight at this striking coincidence. Oliver introduced me to them and explained that they were visiting him on a legal matter. Her name was Nomzamo Winifred Madikizela, but she was known as Winnie. She had recently completed her studies at the Jan Hofmeyr School of Social Work in Johannesburg and was working as the first black female social worker at Baragwanath Hospital. At the time, I paid little attention to her background or legal problem, for something in me was deeply stirred by her presence. I was thinking more of how I could ask her out than how our firm would handle her case. I cannot say for certain if there is such a thing as love at first sight, but I do know that the moment I first glimpsed Winnie Nomzamo, I knew that I wanted to have her as my wife. Winnie was the sixth of 11 children of C.K. Madikizela, a school principal turned businessman. Her given name was Nomzamo, which means one who strives or undergoes trials, a name as prophetic as my own. She came from Bizana in Pondoland, an area adjacent to the part of the Transkei where I grew up. She is from the Pondo clan of Amanungiana, and her great-grandfather was Madikizela, a powerful chief from 19th century Natal who settled in the Transkei at the time of the Amafisane. I telephoned Winnie the next day at the hospital and asked her for help in raising money for the Treason Trial Defense Fund from the Jan Hofmeyr School. It was merely a pretext to invite her to lunch, which I did. I picked her up where she was staying in town and took her to an Indian restaurant near my office, one of the few places that served Africans, and where I frequently ate. Winnie was dazzling, and even the fact that she had never before tasted curry and drank glass after glass of water to cool her palate only added to her charm. After lunch, I took her for a drive to an area between Johannesburg and Everton, an open veld just past Eldorado Park. We walked on the long grass, grass so similar to that of the Transkei where we both had been raised. I told her of my hopes and of the difficulties of the treason trial. I knew right there that I wanted to marry her, and I told her so. Her spirit, her passion, her youth, her courage, her willfulness. I felt all of these things the moment I first saw her. Over the next few weeks and months, we saw each other whenever we could. She visited me at the drill hall and at my office. She came to see me work out in the gym. She met Tembi, Makato, and Makaziwe. She came to meetings and political discussions. I was both courting her and politicizing her. As a student, Winnie had been attracted to the non-European unity movement, for she had a brother who was involved with that party. In later years, I would tease her about this early allegiance, telling her that had she not met me, she would have married a leader of the NEUM. Shortly after I filed for divorce from Evelyn, I told Winnie she should visit Ray Harmel, the wife of Michael Harmel, for a fitting for a wedding dress. In addition to being an activist, Ray was an excellent dressmaker. I asked Winnie how many bridesmaids she intended to have, and suggested she go to Bizana to inform her parents that we were to be married. Winnie has laughingly told people that I never proposed to her, but I always told her that I asked her on our very first date and that I simply took it for granted from that day forward. The treason trial was in its second year, and it put a suffocating weight on our law practice. Mandela and Tambo was falling apart as we could not be there, and both Oliver and I were experiencing grave financial difficulties. Since the charges against Oliver had been dropped, he was able to do some remedial work, but the damage had already been done. We had gone from a bustling practice that turned people away to one that was practically begging for clients. I could not even afford to pay the £50 balance still owing on the plot of land that I had purchased in Umtata, and had to give it up. I explained all this to Winnie, I told her it was more than likely that we would have to live on her small salary as a social worker. Winnie understood and said she was prepared to take the risk and throw in her lot with me. I never promised her gold and diamonds, and I was never able to give her them. The wedding took place on June 14, 1958. I applied for a relaxation of my banning orders and was given 6 days' leave of absence from Johannesburg. I also arranged for lobola, the traditional bride price, to be paid to Winnie's father. The wedding party left Johannesburg very early on the morning of June 12th, and we arrived in Bizana late that afternoon. My first stop, as always when one was banned, was the police station to report that I had arrived. At dusk, we then went to the bride's place, Umbongawene, as was customary. We were met by a great chorus of local women, ululating with happiness, and Winnie and I were separated. She went to the bride's house while I went with the groom's party to the house of one of Winnie's relations. The ceremony itself was at a local church, after which we celebrated at the home of Winnie's eldest brother, which was the ancestral home of the Madikizela clan. The bridal car was swathed in ANC colors. There was dancing and singing, and Winnie's exuberant grandmother did a special dance for all of us. The entire executive of the ANC had been invited, but bands limited their attendance. Among those who came were Duma Nokwe, Lillian Ngoye, Dr. James Njongwe, Dr. Wilson Konko, and Victor Tiamzashi. The final reception was at the Bizana Town Hall. The speech I recall best was given by Winnie's father. He took note, as did everyone, that among the uninvited guests at the wedding were a number of security police. He spoke of his love for his daughter, my commitment to the country, and my dangerous career as a politician. When Winnie had first told him of the marriage, he had exclaimed, "But you are marrying a jailbird!" At the wedding, he said he was not optimistic about the future, and that such a marriage, in such difficult times, would be unremittingly tested. He told Winnie she was marrying a man who was already married to the struggle. He bade his daughter good luck, and ended his speech by saying, "If your man is a wizard, you must become a witch." It was a way of saying that you must follow your man on whatever path he takes. After that, Constance Mbekene, my sister, spoke on my behalf at the ceremony. After the ceremony, a piece of the wedding cake was wrapped up for the bride to bring to the groom's ancestral home for the second part of the wedding. But it was never to be, for my leave of absence was up and we had to return to Johannesburg. Winnie carefully stored the cake in anticipation of that day. At our house, number 8115 Orlando West, a large party of friends and family were there to welcome us back. A sheep had been slaughtered, and there was a feast in our honor. There was no time or money for a honeymoon, and life quickly settled into a routine dominated by the trial. We woke very early in the morning, usually at about 4. Winnie prepared breakfast before I left. I would then take the bus to the trial, or make an early morning visit to my office. As much as possible, afternoons and evenings were spent at my office attempting to keep our practice going and to earn some money. Evenings were often taken up with political work and meetings. The wife of a freedom fighter is often like a widow, even when her husband is not in prison. Though I was on trial for treason, Winnie gave me cause for hope. I felt as though I had a new and second chance at life. My love for her gave me added strength for the struggles that lay ahead. Chapter 27. The major event facing the country in 1958 was the general election. General only in the sense that 3 million whites could participate, but none of the 13 million Africans. We debated whether or not to stage a protest. The central issue was, did an election in which only whites could participate make any difference to Africans? The answer, as far as the ANC was concerned, was that we could not remain indifferent, even when we were shut out of the process. We were excluded, but not unaffected. The defeat of the National Party would be in our interest and that of all Africans. The ANC joined with the other congresses and SACTU, the South African Congress of Trade Unions, to call a 3-day strike during the elections in April. Leaflets were distributed in factories and shops, at railway stations and bus stops, in beer halls and hospitals, and from house to house. "The Nats must go," was the main slogan of this campaign. Our preparations worried the government. 4 days before the election, the state ruled that a gathering of more than 10 Africans in any urban area was illegal. The night before a planned protest, boycott, or stay away, the leaders of the event would go underground in order to foil the police swoop that inevitably took place. The police were not yet monitoring us around the clock, and it was easy to disappear for a day or two. The night before the strike, Walter, Oliver, Moses Kotane, J.B. Marks, Dan Tlume, Duma Nokwe, and I stayed in the house of Dr. Ntato Modlana, my physician in Orlando. Very early the next morning, we moved to another house in the same neighborhood, where we were able to keep in touch by telephone with other leaders around the city. Communications were not very efficient in those days, particularly in the townships where few people owned telephones, and it was a frustrating task to oversee a strike. We dispatched men to strategic places around the townships to watch the trains, buses, and taxis in order to determine whether or not people were going to work. They returned with bad news. The buses and trains were filled. People were ignoring the strike. Only then did we notice that the gentleman in whose house we were staying was nowhere to be found. He had slipped out and gone to work. The strike was shaping up as a failure. We resolved to call off the strike. A 3-day strike that is cancelled on the first day is only a 1-day failure. A strike that fails 3 days running is a fiasco. It was humiliating to have to retreat, but we felt that it would have been more humiliating not to. Less than 1 hour after we had released a statement calling off the strike, the government-run South African Broadcasting Corporation read our announcement in full. Normally, the SABC ignored the ANC altogether. Only in defeat did we make their broadcasts. This time they even complimented us on calling off the strike. This greatly annoyed Moses Kotane. "To be praised by the SABC, that is too much," he said, shaking his head. Kotane questioned whether we had acted too hastily and played into the state's hands. It was a legitimate concern, but decisions should not be taken out of pride or embarrassment, but out of pure strategy. And strategy here suggested we call off the strike. The fact that the enemy had exploited our surrender didn't mean we were wrong to surrender. But some areas did not hear that the strike was called off, while others spurned our call. In Port Elizabeth, an ANC stronghold, and other areas of the Cape, the response was better on the second and third days than the first. In general, however, we could not hide the fact that the strike was a failure. As if that were not enough, the nationalists increased their popular vote in the election by more than 10%. We had heated discussions about whether we ought to have relied on coercive measures. Should we have used pickets, which generally prevent people from entering their place of work? The hardliners suggested that if we had deployed pickets, the strike would have been a success. But I have always resisted such methods. It is best to rely on the freely given support of the people, otherwise that support is weak and fleeting. The organization should be a haven, not a prison. However, if the majority of the organization or the people support a decision, coercion can be used in certain cases against the dissident minority in the interests of the majority. A minority, however vocal, should not be able to frustrate the will of the majority. In my own house, I attempted to use a different sort of coercion, but without success. Ida Mtimkulu, a Sotho-speaking woman of my own age, was then our house assistant. Ida was more a member of the family than an employee, and I called her sister. Ida ran the house with military efficiency, and Winnie and I took our orders willingly. I often ran out to do errands at her command. The day before the strike, I was driving Ida and her 12-year-old son home, and I mentioned that I needed her to wash and press some shirts for me the following day. A long and uncharacteristic silence followed. Ida then turned to me and said with barely concealed disdain, "You know very well that I can't do that." "Why not?" I replied, surprised by the vehemence of her reaction. "Have you forgotten that I, too, am a worker?" she said with some satisfaction. "I will be on strike tomorrow with my people and fellow workers." Her son saw my embarrassment and in his boyish way tried to ease the tension by saying that Uncle Nelson had always treated her as a sister, not a worker. In irritation, she turned on her well-meaning son and said, "Boy, where were you when I was struggling for my rights in that house? If I had not fought hard against your Uncle Nelson, I would not today be treated like a sister." Ida did not come to work the next day, and my shirts went unpressed. Chapter 28. Few issues touched a nerve as much as that of passes for women. The state had not weakened in its resolve to impose passes on women, and women had not weakened in their resolve to resist. Although the government now called passes reference books, women weren't fooled. They could still be fined £10 or imprisoned for a month for failing to produce their reference book. In 1957, spurred by the efforts of the ANC Women's League, women all across the country, in rural areas and in cities, reacted with fury to the state's insistence that they carry passes. The women were courageous, persistent, enthusiastic, indefatigable, and their protest against passes set a standard for anti-government protest that was never equaled. As Chief Latuli said, "When the women begin to take an active part in the struggle, no power on earth can stop us from achieving freedom in our lifetime." All across the southeastern Transvaal, in Standerton, Heidelberg, Balfour, and other dorps, thousands of women protested. On recess from the treason trial, Frances Bard and Florence Matomela organized women to refuse passes in Port Elizabeth, their hometown. In Johannesburg in October, a large group of women gathered at the central pass office and chased away women who had come to collect passes and clerks who worked in the office, bringing the office to a standstill. Police arrested hundreds of the women. Not long after these arrests, Winnie and I were relaxing after supper when she quietly informed me that she intended to join the group of Orlando women who would be protesting the following day at the pass office. I was a bit taken aback, and while I was pleased at her sense of commitment and admired her courage, I was also wary. Winnie had become increasingly politicized since our marriage, and had joined the Orlando West branch of the ANC's Women's League, all of which I encouraged. I told her I welcomed her decision, but that I had to warn her about the seriousness of her action. It would, I said in a single act, radically change her life. By African standards, Winnie was from a well-to-do family and had been shielded from some of the more unpleasant realities of life in South Africa. At the very least, she never had had to worry about where her next meal was coming from. Before our marriage, she had moved in circles of relative wealth and comfort, a life very different from the often hand-to-mouth existence of the freedom fighter. I told her that if she was arrested, she would be certain to be fired by her employer, the provincial administration. We both knew that it was her small income that was supporting the household and that she could probably never work again as a social worker, since the stigma of imprisonment would make public agencies reluctant to hire her. Finally, she was pregnant, and I warned her of the physical hardship and humiliations of jail. My response may sound harsh, but I felt responsibility both as a husband and as a leader of the struggle to be as clear as possible about the ramifications of her action. I myself had mixed emotions, for the concerns of a husband and a leader do not always coincide. But Winnie is a determined person, and I suspect my pessimistic reaction only strengthened her resolve. She listened to all I said and informed me that her mind was made up. The next morning, I rose early to make her breakfast, and we drove over to the Sisulu's house to meet Walter's wife, Albertina, one of the leaders of the protest. We then drove to the Pefeni station in Orlando, where the women would get the train into town. I embraced her before she boarded the train. Winnie was nervous, yet resolute, as she waved to me from the train, and I felt as though she were setting out on a long and perilous journey, the end of which neither of us could know. Hundreds of women converged on the Central Pass office in downtown Johannesburg. They were old and young. Some carried babies on their backs, some wore tribal blankets, while others had on smart suits. They sang, marched, and chanted. Within minutes, they were surrounded by dozens of armed police who arrested all of them, packed them into vans, and drove them to Marshall Square Police Station. The women were cheerful throughout. As they were being driven away, some called out to reporters, "Tell our madams we won't be at work tomorrow." All told, more than 1,000 women were arrested. I knew this not because I was the husband of one of the detainees, but because Mandela and Tambo had been called on to represent most of the women who had been arrested. I quickly made my way to Marshall Square to visit the prisoners and arrange bail. I managed to see Winnie, who beamed when she saw me and seemed as happy as one could be in a bare police cell. It was as if she had given me a great gift that she knew would please me. I told her I was proud of her, but I could not stay and talk, as I had quite a lot of legal work to do. By the end of the second day, the number of arrests had increased, and nearly 2,000 women were incarcerated, many of them remanded to the fort to await trial. This created formidable problems not only for Oliver and me, but for the police and the prison authorities. There was simply not enough space to hold them all. There were too few blankets, too few mats and toilets, and too little food. Conditions at the fort were cramped and dirty. While many in the ANC, including myself, were eager to bail out the women, Lillian Ngoyi, the national president of the Women's League, and Helen Joseph, secretary of the South African Women's Federation, believed that for the protest to be genuine and effective, the women should serve whatever time the magistrate ordered. I demonstrated with them, but was told in no uncertain terms that the matter was the women's affair and that the ANC, as well as anxious husbands, should not meddle. I did tell Lillian that I thought she should discuss the issue with the women themselves before making a decision, and escorted her down to the cells where she could poll the prisoners. Many were desperate to be bailed out and had not been adequately prepared for what would await them in prison. As a compromise, I suggested to Lillian that the women spend a fortnight in prison, after which we would bail them out. Lillian accepted. Over the next 2 weeks, I spent many hours in court arranging bail for the women. A few were frustrated and took their anger out on me. "Mandela, I am tired of this case of yours," one woman said to me. "If this does not end today, I will not ever reappear in court." With the help of relatives and fundraising organizations, we managed to bail them all out within 2 weeks. Winnie did not seem the worse for wear from her prison experience. If she had suffered, she would not have told me anyway. While she was in prison, Winnie became friendly with two teenaged Afrikaner wardresses. They were sympathetic and curious, And after Winnie was released on bail, we invited them to visit us. They accepted and traveled by train to Orlando. We gave them lunch at the house, and afterward, Winnie took them for a tour of the township. Winnie and the two wardresses were about the same age and got on well.